You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Studio One here in London. This is Emma Nelson. On today's programme, a drama avoids becoming a crisis as Tehran frees US Navy sailors who'd strayed into Iranian waters. My studio guests Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox will assess what having a friendly Iran feels like. Also ahead, did Obama's final State of the Union speech cement his legacy? We'll look at whether his words turned "yes we can" into "yes we did." Plus, would giving Assad safe passage prove the turning point in Syria? There's a chance that Putin may grant him asylum. All that plus more in the next 30 minutes live here on Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. So a very warm welcome to Studio One. My guests today to unpick the news, Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian newspapers, and Robert Fox, the defence editor of the London Evening Standard newspaper. Welcome. Let us begin with 10 lucky sailors. It is, of course, almost too grown up to be true. Two US patrol boats stray into Iranian waters. Their 10 crew are arrested. But before the sailors even have time to etch one single notch into the walls of their cells, they are released. The US says, sorry, no harm done. We are, of course, just days away from sanctions being lifted following the deal on Iran's nuclear programme. Mary, this is very, very grown-up behaviour, isn't it? It almost seems too good to be true.
It's quite extraordinary because when the 10 crew members were detained, you had the whole vision of what happened when a British boat strayed into Iranian waters and the crew was detained. They were paraded on television. They were presented as spies. They had a truly horrible time. And British diplomacy had to exert all its sort of minimal power to get them out. And this seems to have been completely the opposite. I think in one way the Americans played it rather well because immediately John Kerry rang up with what appears to have been a rather fulsome and generous apology. So I think that may have helped. But obviously the national interests, not just of the United States, but of Iran, were absolutely crucial here.
Lots of developing what you say there. Let's touch briefly, Robert, on this intervention by John Kerry before they went into the State of the Union speech. John Kerry said, we're going to get them out. And there is this a lot being mentioned today about the good relations between Kerry and the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. How much do you think this hands-on approach that Kerry's taken for such a long time helped?
Come on, they're two real old pros, these two, and they know each other very, very well. Zarif has been around for ages, as Mary will know, that he was a very effective permanent representative of Iran at the UN, absolutely flawless English, as with the president. And we know that the relations, personal relations, are very good. And Kerry was smart enough to realise this was an absolute boo-boo. The wretched boat had run out of petrol or whatever and drifted, and they did put their hands up. They said probably we were in Iranian territorial waters around Farsi Island, and there was absolutely no messing about. I think the really interesting thing was that nobody, pardon the pun, tried to torpedo Zarif and Rouhani, because, as I think Mary and I have discussed with you before, that there are a lot of hardliners, some in quite unexpected places in Iran, who really don't like the deal with the US. And with us, as Mary was saying, being just days away from sanctions possibly being lifted as they go forward with the nuclear negotiations, one would have thought that these hotheads, and they are very present, I understand, in the younger leadership of the Revolutionary Guard, might have had a go. But amazingly, as you said, sheer common sense prevailed.
This is the test being passed, the first international test, isn't it, in anticipation of these sanctions being lifted. Of course, that agreement followed the deal over the Iranian nuclear programme. To what degree was this done with Iran entirely with its eyes open, with its eyes on the goal for those sanctions to go as early as next week?
I think that is probably a prime consideration. But I also think that, I mean, Iran seems to have acted really beyond the call of duty, because what surprised me about this was less the speed with which the crews were released, which was quite extraordinary in a way, but the fact that Iran put out a statement saying, we accept that this was a genuine mistake and these guys had no intention of spying. Now, you don't actually have to do that. All you have to do is let them go. So I think that there is really a degree of overcompensation and extra goodwill here, which suggests that indeed their eyes are on the prize of having sanctions lifted.
There's plenty of goodwill here, but it has been reported that Iran did expect an apology before they did anything.
Yes, and it appears that they've got an apology and they got one almost before they actually asked for it.
The only crossword from Iran was, I think, the rather gruff commander of the Iranian Navy. And the Iranian Navy is pretty good at what it does down there and is much feared. And he said this was just downright incompetence by the Americans. They drifted for 40 minutes and we realised we had to do something. There was something to show that even the Iranians didn't really want to do anything. But one very important point, of course, is this reasonableness after the high rhetoric and shouting from Saudi Arabia and the Arab coalition over the executions just 10 days ago. It really is very, very important. And I don't think in Riyadh they could be too happy with the way that there has been a love-in led by Mr. Kerry and Mr. Zarif over this, because it has shown the Arab world, for good and all, that America is serious about engagement with Iran. And I know we're going to talk about it with view of the State of the Union. Maybe one of the most important, certainly Middle East legacies of Barack Obama.
Mary, what do you think, whether this loving that Robert has just described actually helps or hinders Iran in the light of the crisis with Saudi Arabia?
I think that Iran, you can say, has acted in a way rather cynically, because I think in showing such a friendly face towards the Americans, it is actually presenting almost the opposite face to the Saudis, and that it is saying, look, we've got our new friends here and we're going to behave in a civilized manner. We don't execute people in this way. We are going to be from now on civilized. And I think that the contrast there is entirely deliberate, and I absolutely agree with Robert that this is a three-cornered thing. It's not just Iran and America. Saudis are there too.
You explained a little while ago about the rather gruff comments from the Iranian Navy. To what degree is the Iranian Navy actually towing the line now? Because there have been reports in the past that the Iranian Navy quite likes to embarrass Mr. Zarif and President Rouhani, that they have their own voice in this.
They did a bit of shooting the other day, too. They did a test of a tactical missile, just a ship launch, not just a ship launch thing, quite close to the American flotilla there. And I think that was quite deliberate. They are very tough. They are largely under the Revolutionary Guard. They are extremely capable and they are feared because they have developed all kinds of tactics, notably swarm tactics with small boats, which takes us back to the incident Mary referred to at the beginning of this, the HMS Cornwall incident, when the hapless British sailors and Royal Marines were paraded and taken prisoner and made fools of, frankly, by the Iranians. The British didn't handle it as well as the Americans because they didn't put their hand up and say, possibly we were straying in territorial waters
they
and tried to bluff it out.
They also decided to have a huge quarrel and very technical quarrel about maps, which they presented.
Exactly. Which
I suspect that the British rather enjoy. But do carry on. Sorry.
They do, yes. But I think following what Mary says, the thing that really is, it does make you think here, is the intellectual horsepower, which is quite apparent in Iranian diplomacy. Because as we've said at quite some length, there was a tremendous opportunity for insiders to wreck this. And another element which could have put the brakes on with the great Satan is the Ayatollah himself, the Supreme Leader. And the Supreme Leader and the Council of Guardians have not said anything about this at all. So they are backing their men, namely Mr. Zarif and Rouhani, contrary to what some people have been leading us to believe. namely the hotheads, the new generation trying to take over the Revolutionary Guard.
This tone in this conversation about Iran feels very different to me. I think this is the first time we've ever had such a convivial, warm and open discussion about Iran's re-emergence onto the diplomatic platform as an efficient and an understanding nation. How much more do you think we're going to get this lovely warm feeling towards Iran? There's an awful lot else to be dealing with.
Well, I think it depends to a large extent on how far the West and the United States in particular responds, and what happens to sanctions, and indeed what happens to sort of regional relations as well. But I wouldn't rule out that it will continue, at least for a while. And I mean, without sort of preempting the link to the State of the Nation's address, I think that the turns that there have been in American foreign policy under President Obama, that the turn towards Iran and the opening to Cuba have been absolutely crucial as part of a complete reorientation and rethinking of America's approach to foreign policy. And I think that is something, and obviously it depends on what happens in the American presidential election, how far that continues. But I think that is a crucial element which shouldn't be underestimated.
And how much, Robert, do you think that the infighting within the Iranian regime about which you've spoken could alter what Mary has just been talking about? There are elections happening in February. There have been accusations that the Iranian foreign minister and the US State Department are getting far too cosy. That will clearly be something which could alter the course of things this year.
Yes, that's the kind of thing that you have to hear, and it always comes up. And there is a very lively, if not necessarily uber-free press in Iran. And I don't think you should discount that, but that sort of thing that's going to happen. But why they're backing Zarif and Rouhani at the moment is that this is the great Persian breakout. It's very interesting. The standoff between the Saudis and the Saudi alliance and the Iranians has been depicted, I think, oversimplistically as Sunni and Shia. There's a lot more behind this. There has been the traditional mistrust and contest between Persian peoples, and of course, as we know, there's a large Azeri minority in Iran, but it is a homogeneous Farsi Persian people. And this is very, very important indeed. I thought that you were possibly going to bring up Syria. I think part of the litmus test is going to be what, if anything, Iran can do vis-a-vis Syria and Hezbollah and President Assad. Because while they're allies, they are not proxies. It's very, very difficult, but they do have influence. And I think that we'll be hearing a lot about that in the next few weeks.
We shall indeed. Let us move on. You're listening to Midori House. My guests in the studio today, Mary Jajewski and Robert Fox. Now, last night's State of the Union address by the US President Barack Obama, his last before he steps down, and was perhaps a little like the speech he delivered when re-elected, his chance to call on America's politicians to fix not just their attitudes, but the political system in general. He said, we need to accept that we've played a role in how and why our government is broken, and then we need to fix it. Quite a statement from a man who, in effect, was trying to cement his legacy last night, Mary.
I found this a very interesting speech, and different in tone from the last final year speeches of the last two-term presidents. Both of them seem to be very bombastic, almost boasting of their achievements, and indeed looking back over the legacy that they wanted to present. I found that Obama seemed to be much more reflective, much more critical in a way, not just of the sort of past 8 years, but also looking ahead. He was looking very much to the long term at a complex American society in the process of change, and the world around him in a process of change that he looked to, not just to the term of the next president, but to the next generation and to the time after that. I mean, this was a very big picture and a very interesting speech, which you wouldn't really credit as being the valedictory speech of the president.
Indeed, one of the things that he says is, one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse in instead of better. Robert, this does not sound, as Mary said, like a bombastic, triumphant president concluding, you know, drawing a neat line under his 8 years. This is someone who almost shoulders the blame himself.
But it is also the analysis of probably one of the most supreme intellectuals that's ever occupied the White House. And that is what was both thrilling and rather disturbing about this. This was probably, if not a great man, a great mind giving a tour d'horizon. And I hadn't picked up quite to the extent that Mary has, because I've been reading other things about it, quite how focused he was, and rightly, on how bad the system is. And things are breaking down, not necessarily on bipartisan polarity, but where that is demonstrated in central administration, federal administration, and the contest between the states. And in a way, I did pick up that this was, there were quite a few good jokes about it, but it was addressed to the present presidential race, where he was not being partisan. He said, but think what you are doing and what you are standing for. And the, you know, the state of the Republican race, the fact is that no front runner is being endorsed by a senator, a senior senator, or a senior governor, is really pretty pretty worrying indeed. I do think, though, because we should focus a bit on foreign policy, and what was interesting was his caution. He saw Islamic State as a threat, as a very big threat, he said, but this is not World War III, and we're not going to have World War III about it.
That was immediately seized upon by an awful lot of people, who again levied the criticism that Obama underestimates IS.
This is a thought, but I think there's another thought that pops up into my head, in that I was on Monocle last night commenting on the Istanbul bombs, which I think are very serious and significant. But what Obama and Kerry seem rightly to be saying, actually, the Eastern Mediterranean, the littoral of the Mediterranean, is primarily a European responsibility, and the United States can't go everywhere, and you must take up the slack. I think that you know, when there is criticism about underestimate of the problems of the Middle East, of Eastern Europe, and so on, I think it is a dialogue of the deaf, because I don't think some of the European leadership, particularly the more isolationist like Mr. Cameron in the UK, is really listening to the dialogue. They're not getting the currency of the Obama logic, which is very, very interesting.
Well, there was a very, very clear contrast. You know, if you were watching or listening to this in the UK, and you heard Obama saying, this is not World War III, this is not an existential threat to the United States. Yes, it is serious. Yes, it threatens civilians in the region and maybe in the US. But it is not, as he said, it is not World War III. And then you listen to Cameron, who basically has described it and hasn't gone back on his description of IS, as he now likes to call it, Daesh, as being an existential threat to UK security.
I wonder who might be right in that, because there has been this accusation, as we said before, about Obama not taking this bit seriously, backtracking on not getting involved when perhaps he should have done. And that criticism will never go away, will it?
It will never go away, but I think the criticism is actually unfounded, or at least the point made that Obama hasn't acted when maybe people have tried to pressure him into acting. That point is valid, but my view is that almost entirely, Obama has been completely right in not acting when he hasn't acted. And I think one of the things that he has, in a way, in common with Angela Merkel, is that both of them look at the situation, they analyse the situation, and they can, as it were, decline to act on the grounds that this might actually make things worse. And I think the wisdom, knowing when to act and when not to act, is extremely important. And it's something that very few leaders, because of the pressure of day-to-day politics, communications, 24/7 media, all those things, the pressure is such that very few actually refrain from acting. And I think sometimes that is the wiser course.
And is that, Robert, something that will be looked back upon in a few years' time as something that was a wise move? We've always, as you just mentioned a few moments ago, always admired Obama's intellectual rigour. That is what has often been criticised as being, you know, levied at a president who is too dry and too unable to actually roll his sleeves up and get hot-headed when he needs to be.
And Frau Merkel, it hadn't struck me until actually Mary said it. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord, as they used to say in the Old Testament. The beginning of strategic wisdom is to calculate a roster of known and possible consequences. This is where the unintended consequences. I've actually done a senior military course on strategic planning, and it's very interesting. And it just struck me, in the case of Hollande, for all his emotional power and sincerity, no doubt, and Cameron, they don't think of the consequences down the road. Just to give an obvious example, when the vote went before the British Parliament in 2013 to whether to bomb Syria or not, quite clearly the Prime Minister hadn't thought through the strategic consequences, what would happen in phase 2, 3, 4, and 5, and how could it be blown off course. Back to Obama particularly. No, he really does think it through. I mean, it is. It reminds me of the great when Kennedy heard the wonderful cellist Casals play in the Oval Office. He said, "This is the most distinguished company in this office since Thomas Jefferson dined here alone." Obama is a great contemplator like Jefferson, and he comes up with some very interesting conclusions, which is what we're discussing now.
But I think in a way his self-criticism was also right, in that he's found it extremely difficult, and he barely learnt over the best part of 8 years to deal with Congress and to somehow to mould Congress, regardless of what party was in charge, to his will. And Clinton learnt that a bit late in the day, but he learnt how to do it. And Bush was extraordinarily good at it.
Another thing, though, that Obama never learnt how to handle the military. Very, very interesting. Because military advice is always full on. He didn't know how to unpick it and deflect it. That's why he had such a bad time in getting Americans out of Afghanistan.
You're listening to Midori House. This is Emma Nelson, joined in the studio by Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we discuss whether IS is mounting a deliberate campaign to isolate the Muslim world from tourism.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. We're live here on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18:22. I'm joined in the studio by Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. Now, could Islamic State terrorists be mounting a deliberate campaign to isolate the Muslim world from the West? The deaths of 10 Germans in Istanbul's Sultanahmet Square was not only the worst attack on Germans abroad in 13 years, it also struck at the heart of Turkey's multi-billion-dollar tourist industry. Mary, we were discussing this before we came on air, saying, is this a concerted effort by Islamic State to target the likes of British tourists in Tunisia, international tourists in Egypt, perhaps we may never know, Russian tourists in Egypt? Is this a pattern, or is this just something that just happens? You're trying to work out when something becomes a thing.
Well, I sort of share the question, and I'm quite reluctant to give an answer, because I tend to think that a little bit like Al-Qaeda was generally accepted to be in its latter stages, that IS is a very useful brand that people adopt to make them sound much more important and their cause much bigger and more compelling than it actually is. So I think that there have been actually three Russian citizens who are presumably Chechens or from the Caucasus, some variety, who have been arrested in connection with the attack in Istanbul. And I think if you put that together with the attacks in Tunisia, the possible downing of the Russian plane in Sinai, if you put those things together, you could argue for a concerted attack on Western tourists and an attempt to undermine those economies which are so dependent on tourism. But I think you can also look at it in another way, that Western tourists generally are actually very vulnerable, especially in those countries where security and policing, all these things are not especially effective. And I think that a lot of people, you know, you don't have to belong to IS. You don't have to adhere to the IS cause to disapprove of Westerners, as it were, coming and enjoying themselves in your country.
How much did this expose Turkey? It is a country which is dealing with all manner of so-called threats from all manner of sources, yet the attack took place in an area which is so heavily guarded by Turkish security forces. The bomber, we think, was known to the services, and yet it just happened.
Yeah, but he was known, apparently, but not regarded as a risk, hey? But there we are. But, you know, Sultanahmet, it's just below the great Topkapi Palace and round the Blue Mosque. I've wandered around there quite a few times. It's really very, very open indeed. And I think Mary is saying, I think two things that are really interesting about this. I slightly disagree about the IS brand. I don't think there's a map on the wall in Raqqa saying, we're going to bomb the Blue Mosque, we're going to bomb suits, we're going to blow up. Doesn't work like that. It's a franchise. It's a bit of outsourcing. It's much nearer medieval armies, which actually weren't state armies. They were armies of freebooters signed up for this, that, and the other. There's a playbook. And the playbook can be read by anybody. And you can say, oops, yes, I'm IS, you know, for the moment. But it's not some great brain in Raqqa or Mosul saying, just go and do this. Although there is a great brain somewhere with a business plan, which we could come on to. But the other point that Mary raised, which I would like to endorse, and did go on rather at length last night on your show about this, is how vulnerable tourism is. I wrote a big book, I'm sorry, boring listeners about this, about the Mediterranean, because I went around the Mediterranean the whole lot in 2 years at the end of the 1980s. It was absolutely clear to me then, and I wrote it, that tourism is an obvious terrorism target because people are vulnerable, there is resentment, and it is rich and poor, and people do get upset. Very poor people drifting through, drifters, whatever, even residents, and see this display of conspicuous wealth. And the fact is that the tourist agencies and the, which I know from firsthand, and governments have not been nearly attentive about this.
One thing that's been picked up is in the German tabloid Bild, saying what their headline has been, was this a targeted attack on us? One wonders how much something that happens in Istanbul becomes meat for a domestic immigration argument.
Yes, I think that this is taking it maybe a little far, but it certainly occurred to me when it was clear that the victims of this attack were Germans, then you make automatically your brain connects to Cologne, it attacks to reprisals and counter-reprisals, and you think, well, maybe there is a connection. I rather suspect actually there isn't.
There's some rather fragrant discussions and thoughts
absolutely
taking place on editorial floor.
But I also thought that it was interesting when the attacks on Sousse in Tunisia happened, most of the victims there were British, but I didn't get much sense, even from the British reporting, that this was any feeling that the British had been particularly targeted, that it was more Westerners that were targeted.
To what degree do you think this is going to affect Turkish tourism now? We've seen a dip in Tunisia. Egypt is in real trouble touristically.
I think since it's open beach holidays a lot that Turkey is known for, I think it will. And I have one piece of evidence for this. If you noticed over Christmas, television commercials and newspapers are full of travel supplements and travel ads, and most of them used to be about come to the sunny Mediterranean, and they've gone off the agenda.
We're all heading to Croatia, aren't we? Thank you very much indeed, Robert Fox and Mary Dujewski, for joining me in the studio. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Carlotta Rabella, our researcher, Jolene Goffin and Aidan McLaughlin, and our studio manager, Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Carlotta will leap out from behind the glass to keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. For this edition of Midori House, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.